we're trying to recover a little bit of lost time here. If you could all please take your seats. We'll have the last two background papers and discussants before then opening up for general discussion. We know it's a long time to ask people to hold off for making comments, but if you'll bear with us, we're almost there. The third presentation of a background paper is by Margaret Crook from the Mailman School here at Columbia, and Julio Frank from Harvard School of Public Health, and Gita Sen from the Indian Institute of Management will be the two discussants for this presentation. So, Margaret.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And let me add a word of thanks on behalf of the Mailman faculty and a word of welcome in particular to those of you who have traveled from many parts of the world to join us today. We're delighted, just delighted to have you here. I'll be speaking briefly on globalization and its impacts on global health governance. So first, let me start with a little bit of nomenclature. I think it's important to note that the shift from the commonly used term international health to the term now in vogue and very much in use, global health, is much more than semantics. I think that it underlines the transition from the focus on the state to a much broader focus on suprastate and supranational factors, including non-state actors and transnational health concerns. Globalization has been defined in many different ways, but one of my favorite definitions is that globalization is the emergence of a world marketplace of goods, services, capital, and ideas, and marked by heightened migration and much easier migration across borders. Underlying all of this is a huge ability and convergence in many areas, in particular the convergence of ideas. This map, you might be wondering what this shows. This is not a virus, this is not a new disease. Rather, this is the 42 countries that have their own version of the American television show American Idol, which is clearly an idea that's taken the world by storm, for better or worse. And here are the 17,000 stores in 49 countries that sell the same non-fat latte that you can get across the street at Starbucks. And again, showing the huge convergence in very disparate issues. Much less felicitously, we have also had the spread of many negative phenomena, including the financial crisis that, as many of you know, started in the suburbs of this country, the United States. But has now spread to faraway places, many of which did not invest in U.S. real estate. For example, I was doing some research in Liberia a couple of years ago when I came across this headline in the local newspaper in October of 2008. This is the headline from the New Democrat of Liberia that was cautioning, calling for a bracing in the fall of remittances that were coming to Liberia and the huge economic impact that that was going to have in that country. Another area is, of course, in the migration of health professionals, something that's already been raised by other speakers. And I just wanted to point out that the emigration of health professionals from sub-Saharan Africa, the ratio of emigrating physicians to physicians left behind is highest and therefore most adverse in the very region where disease burden is also highest, which is sub-Saharan Africa. So, summing up very, very briefly, it's clear that globalization has brought a tremendous amount of progress. In fact, hundreds of millions have been lifted from poverty in countries such as China in particular, India, and other countries that have been able to respond to opportunities unlocked by the liberalization of trade. At the same time, it is also very clear that gains in health and gains in wealth have been very unevenly distributed. And here's two examples. This slide shows preventable deaths, and these are deaths due to maternal causes, nutritional deficiencies, and infectious diseases. And it shows by expanding the borders of a typical map where these are concentrated. Preventable deaths today are disproportionately concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And these inequities haven't only been magnified across countries, but also critically within countries. And we've already heard the concerns about equity, and we'll hear more about them. But just to make the point that this is maternal mortality, the maternal mortality ratio on the y-axis, and three countries in different parts of the world, we have Tanzania, Peru, and Indonesia, what you see is that the left-handmost bar, which is the blue bar, is the maternal mortality ratio among the poorest fifth of women in that country, and on the right-hand side, the richest fifth. And what you can see from here is that the chance of dying is more than double in some parts of the world, very different parts of the world. So there are huge, huge health inequities within countries as well. In part, to respond to the threats and the opportunities brought by globalization, we've had an unprecedented global set of actions and policies. And key among these has been the Millennium Declaration, which, as you know, was signed by 189 world leaders in the year 2000. And the Millennium Declaration very explicitly took on a role in redistributing the benefits of globalization. It really saw as its mandate that redistribution. And specifically, important to us in health are Millennium Goals 4, 5, and 6 on child mortality, maternal mortality, and the spread of infectious disease. These goals have committed the global community to achieving quantified and actually quite ambitious targets by the year 2015, which is 5 years away. I think many of these will not, in fact, be reached, and is one of the challenges before this conference. What was heartening post the MDGs was the tremendous response that I think, at least in part, can be attributed to the Millennium Development Goals, and in part to other forces and other recognitions, other sources of recognition that globalization needs to be managed. And this slide shows the entrance the increase in funding for global health between 1990 on the left-hand side and 2008 on the right-hand. Just looking at the difference between the year 2000 and 2008, there's been a doubling just in those 8 years of funding for global health activities worldwide. There's one other thing I'd like to draw your attention to in this slide, which is the proliferation of colors. And these are the different actors, the different funders, sources of funding. And what you can see on the right-hand side is we have a number, the light green bar on top is non-governmental organizations, for example, and the red on the bottom is bilateral organizations, so country-to-country assistance, and others in between. But we have not only a lot more money, but we have a huge new field of actors, all with ideas. So amidst the new money and amidst the new actors, there have also been, and I think, again, on the background of concerns around globalization, there has also been innovation, tremendous innovation in scholarship, in advocacy, and in policy around issues such as equity and vulnerability, women's rights and role, and increasingly concerned about accountability of all this programming to society and civil society, and the role of civil society in determining the flows of some of these resources. So I think, in a way, it's counterbalanced. It's not just about new money coming in, but we've also got new concerns heightened. They're not new concerns, actually. They're quite old concerns in public health. But I think that their contribution is growing in the discussion about solutions. At the same time, all of this expansion in funding and ideas and activity has exposed very large gaps in knowledge and in needed evidence. And in particular, I want to highlight a few areas in which evidence is desperately needed, I would say. One clear area, which Professor Jacobs will be addressing much more in a following discussion, is on how to scale up health systems. We know how to maximize efficacy in a small setting. We don't know how to create effectiveness at scale, as Hassan Shinda pointed out. We also need much more information about how to improve health outcomes for the most vulnerable, including the examples from Chile that we just saw. How do we reach those women? How do we change the intractable public health manager's perception of innovation? Seemingly intractable, hopefully. There are some new methods and new approaches. Dean Fried pointed out, not only do we have huge new challenges, but we have some emerging, exciting approaches and methods to deal with those challenges, including the evolution of complex adaptive systems and its applications to health and public health, implementation research, and many, many others. These are just two focused on the delivery of innovations here on this page. So all of this leads us to the question that other speakers have already also raised, which is who's in charge and how do we balance the problems on the one hand and the promising solutions on the other? There seems to be the need for an intermediary and even moreover, a leader or a set of leaders who can take these ideas forward. On the one hand, again, we have these new challenges, and not just new challenges, but challenges across borders. On the other hand, the new money and the new actors have caused the fragmentation, widely acknowledged fragmentation, in global health governance. In 1990, the world, even this may not look that simple, but I promise it only gets more complicated. In 1990, the World Health Organization was really the arbiter, the convener, the policymaker, the policy setter in global health in terms of the flow of funds, the flow of policies, the advice to countries. And again, the World Health Organization has 192 member states, so representing multiple perspectives and approaches and recognizing needs. And underneath that were a number of other partners, and I've listed some of the large bilateral institutions, essentially country-to-country partnerships, two-way partnerships. This has changed dramatically. This is 2010. And what we see now, and also what I pointed out in the funding graph, is that we have new partners in 2010 who didn't even exist, actually, in 2000 when the MDGs were first adopted. In particular, we have the emergence of global health initiatives, which are public, private, multi-stakeholder, often disease-focused or single area-focused initiatives, private foundations with tremendous new resources and much narrower chains of accountability. Yet despite this proliferation of money and ideas, or perhaps because of it, I think that there's a new challenge in that the challenge of low-income countries and their role in governance continues to be very, very problematic at the country level. I think it is still very, very challenging for countries and partners I work in Africa, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, to put their ideas forward and to actually corral the partners around national strategies. So I want to end with some challenges for public health. I think there are many implications of the forces of globalization and the fragmentation in global health governance, and I think some of them have very urgent challenges that they pose for those of us in public health. First among those, frankly, is what is the role of public health in global health governance? Should we be speaking up more? Should we be taking a greater stand, given the close alignment, as Dean Fried and many other speakers have pointed out, between the core values, core approaches, and core aims of public health and the problems we see before us right now in global health? Secondly, how do we improve translation of research to policy? Again, Peter Piot has raised this, others have raised this as well. It's not good enough for researchers to publish in their own journals right now. That is not an adequate response. That is not a response commensurate with the size of the problem. I think we need to spend a great deal more time and money in thinking through how to translate, I think, some of the important findings in literature to realities on the ground for people. Who are the new allies? Part of the reason for this conference is to bring together not just the expected, but the new faces, and maybe faces that don't sit together in meetings very frequently, and think together about how we can reshape responses, because it's very clear that siloed thinking is not going to get us there. Another area is there's clearly a number of different kinds of evidence required for global public health governance. What are those pieces of information needed? When I work in countries, I often start with the Ministry of Health and say, what is it you need to know about your healthcare system, and how can we help you? And I think conversations have to involve more partners even than that in shaping research agendas. And lastly, as training institutions and research institutions, I think we're all struggling still with how to promote equity and how to increase access to those wonderful resources and knowledge and scientific approaches outside of North America and Europe, and really expand those throughout, and particularly in low-income countries. And again, new technologies are available to us, new ways of thinking and collaborating. The funding and the organizational approaches aren't necessarily there right now to support it. And I think, again, it's one of the challenges before us in this conference to think through. Let me end here. Thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. And for our first discussant, Dean Julio Frank from Harvard University.
Good morning to everyone. I want first of all to thank our hosts for bringing us together, especially Linda Fried and Richard Parker, and of course the other the leaders of the other organizers, Peter Piot and Harrison Spencer, for this convening all of us to analyze these very timely topics. I read with great interest. I'm going to give you a PowerPoint break, okay? No PowerPoints. So I read with great interest the background paper prepared by Margaret Kruk on global health governance. And the first thing I like to say about her paper is that I completely agree with her view of globalization. We have this tendency to confuse globalization with global integration, and that's a very serious conceptual mistake. The current model of globalization very often, at its very essence, implies exclusion, and of course it implies huge problems of inequity. Hillary Clinton recently spoke of the wrong side of globalization, and I think we must not lose sight of that component. I also share her idea about the way in which the health has actually become much more prominent in the global agenda. And to my mind, really the big difference this decade, this first decade of the 21st century, has been that health stopped being the concern only of domain experts, like most of us here, and started becoming a central part of the most pressing issues on the global agenda. The agenda of economic development, the agenda of national and global security, the agenda of democratic governance, and the agenda of human rights protection and promotion. This is the big shift. I've been active in global health for about 25 years, and this is what I see as the change around the year 2000. And I have to say that part of this, I really think, was due also to the amazing leadership of Gro Brundtland as Director General of WHO, who having been the first and only former head of government to lead that agency, she had this idea that we needed to broaden the place of health in the global agenda. But this is, to me, what explains, first of all, this huge expansion in funding. If we bring the data from that paper up to 2010, actually we now see a tripling of funding from in this first decade, from about a little bit less than 11 billion in the year 2000 to almost 30 billion. But more important is the expansion of funding in national budgets. And then, of course, a corollary of this has also been this explosion of pluralism in the global health scene that makes the governance question so much more important. So it's really a new era in global health, but that is, to my mind, the essential feature. And this requires, indeed, public health to make a fundamental contribution. And the paper, I think, lays out a number of very interesting questions, which Margaret just summarized in her last slide. Of course, a very major question is, how do we navigate this new space? Every speaker has addressed the question, you know, what is global health? How do we, not in terms of a formal definition, but how do we think about it? And it's already been said, I mean, very often we're in the presence of what someone has called a linguistic updating, meaning that we just changed the word from international to global health, but we're really still meaning exactly the same thing. And to my mind, there are two identities that I think we need to break. Implicit in the way we think and act is the idea of global health, particularly in rich countries, the idea of global health as foreign health. Global health is the health of the others. It's what, you know, very often my colleagues at Harvard, when they say I'm in global health, it means whatever they're doing when they're not in the United States. And that is not global health. Global health is not foreign health, nor is global the opposite of domestic. The second identity is this idea that problems flow from south to north and solutions flow from north to south. A very common misconception. And the third identity is this idea that we have a simple allocation of problems. Not this group, which is a very sophisticated group, but very often we still have this identity that the agenda is simple, communicable diseases are the problems of poor countries, non-communicable diseases are the problems of wealthy nations. And one problem we often fail to see is what I like to distinguish between problems only of the poor. For example, malaria, maternal mortality are problems only of the poor. But what makes the situation very complex is that problems only of the poor are no longer the only problems of the poor. The poor also face much higher rates of the chronic diseases, and I agree with Peter, we should coin a new term, but it's also the fact that the agenda became much more complex and we don't no longer live in this world of simple dichotomies. So to my mind, the key construct here is the notion of interdependence, what Lincoln Chen in a paper about 15 years ago called health interdependence. And global health has to be about understanding the nature of interdependence as it affects the health sphere. And that, of course, includes disparities that are derived from the current model of globalization. We're talking about global public health, and the essence of public health is that it takes a population level of analysis. So what is the population when we talk about global health? It's, of course, the population of the entire world, beyond the way people happen to be grouped in nation states. But it also includes not just the people, but the actors that operate on the global stage, as Margaret very nicely put it. And these are multilateral organizations, transnational corporations, global civil society movements, and the emergence of a whole set of new actors. And very importantly, by the way, since we are in a university, academic institutions, because academic institutions are charged with producing one of the quintessential global public goods, which is knowledge. But in public health, we always, at least it helped me, to think that we have two fundamental objects of study. We study health conditions, and then we study the response of society to those conditions. When we take that to the global level, to me, when we study health conditions, the fundamental construct to understand interdependence is the notion of the global transfer of health risks, in a notion that with a consultation that was organized by the Rockefeller Foundation in the late 90s in Pocantico came up as a very important notion, the global transfer of health risks, which occurs as a result of six processes: the rise of global environmental threats like climate change, the movement of people across national boundaries, the adoption of risky lifestyles across cultures. Then one very important that shows that problems not only move from south to north, because one form of global transfer of health risk is the variance among countries in environmental and occupational health and safety standards, the practice of setting shop in countries that have lower regulatory environment. That's a form of active transfer of health risk, usually from north to south. Then the trade in harmful products, another example of risks flowing from north to south. And some of these harmful products may be legal, like tobacco, or illegal, like other drugs. And then finally, the spread of medical technologies, which give rise to phenomena like antimicrobial resistance and other issues. So when we study health conditions, the global transfer of health risks is a fundamental construct to understand interdependence. But as I say, in public health, we also study the response to those conditions. And this is also what we need to do at the global level. How do we respond? And this, of course, addresses the central question of global governance. We respond to a series of institutions, both in the multilateral system, but also increasingly in the civil society system and in the private for-profit system. And this organized social response is at the national level what health systems do. This is what we're going to talk in the next session. But at the global level, we might think of a global health system, not as an organizational entity, but as a set of structured relationships among those actors that populate the global space. So this, to me, what is this global health system, is the key question of global health governance. And let me briefly, to finish, address a set of specific issues around governance. To me, if we're going to articulate a new vision for global health in the 21st century, there are two fundamental questions: global governance and global ethics. Let me briefly mention. For global governance, to me, I think we need to address two paradoxes. The first one is what I call the sovereignty paradox. And this paradox states that in a world of sovereign nation states, and by the way, there was a whole literature on the end of the nation state, and I'm still planning to write a book called The End of the End of the Nation State. Because what happened when those books were rewritten is that the number of nation states actually exploded. So yeah, there's now 192 members of WHO. And then there's about 50, you know, quasi-national entities out there. So there's no end to the sovereign state. So in a world where the world polity is organized in a sovereign national state, health continues to be primarily a national responsibility. I have been a minister of health in my own country, in Mexico, and I was responsible for anything that happened to the 100 million Mexicans in terms of their health. You know, it didn't matter if it was an epidemic coming from somewhere else. It is a national responsibility. Yet, here's the paradox, the determinants of that health and the means to deal with those problems are now beyond the control of any one given government, including the most powerful governments of the world. So no individual country, no matter how powerful, can generate on its own an effective response to most global challenges. This is the sovereignty paradox. The way to solve this paradox is not for nation states to give up, but rather to share sovereignty. And the notion of shared sovereignty is the core of the idea of international collective action, which is the whole rationale why we have a multilateral system. It's to generate international collective action. But this requires a different way of thinking, and it requires fundamentally an allocation of functions among all these actors. I'll talk a little bit about that. But let me talk about the second paradox. The second paradox I call the dissonance paradox. Because as has been said, starting with Judith Rodin in her very, very brilliant speech this morning, there is a growing interest in health systems, and we're going to talk about that in the next paper. But this interest at the national level has not been accompanied by a similar interest at the global level. So the very same agencies that are now offering technical assistance to national governments to rearrange their health systems have been incapable themselves to create a global health system that follows the same principles of rationality that they preach to individual governments. So this is the dissonance paradox. We have to think in terms of a global health system, not as an organizational entity, but as a structured set of relationships among actors that perform different functions. And this system, as was clearly expressed in the paper by Margaret, is characterized by this explosion of pluralism. There are now about 120 international agencies and partnerships, including very creative ways of new forms of governance, what I call quasi-multilateral organizations like Gavi or the Global Fund. Of course, UNAIDS itself was a whole new form of thinking about the UN system. The health arena has been, just has had this explosion of creativity in ways of thinking about international collective action, but we have been victims of our own success. I think this is, in many respects, a welcome development. There's been a lot of innovation, of new thinking, but it has created a problem, because the problem is that this broad variety of actors has not been able to develop an effective global health system with the capacity to act in a concerted manner. So we have problems of fragmentation, as expressed in the background paper, lack of coordination, huge transaction costs, especially at the country level, and an inefficient overlap of some functions while others remain neglected. So what are those functions? To my mind, there are three fundamental functions that need to be carried out at the global level. First, the production of global public goods. Second, the management of externalities across countries. And third, the mobilization of global solidarity. The most conventional approaches to global health only focus on the last of this, and it's very important, but there are the other two. And I am very distressed to see the in this context of explosion of funding, the total underfunding of global public goods. Global public goods are research methods, comparative analysis that can generate shared learning across countries, norms and standards. One of the things I marvel at is that something so culturally specific as death, and the fact that there, every single country in the world classifies death with exactly the same terminology, the International Classification of Diseases, is an amazing achievement. Yet, this is not the sexy part of global health. No one stands here and shows a slide about the... It doesn't get our juices flowing, as I said this morning. I would like to see Bono, launch a campaign for the International Classification of Diseases. Without that, we couldn't do anything. And this part of global collective action is totally underfunded. The second is, of course, all the coordination mechanisms to manage externalities, for example, in the face of pandemics. When a country is not epidemiologically transparent, then we fail at that. And we've made some progress with international health regulations and others, but this is very important. And then, of course, the third big function is the mobilization of global solidarity, which, by the way, is a much better term and less asymmetrical than aid. And that includes development financing, technical cooperation, and humanitarian assistance in a very important manner. So the first thing we need to do is arrive to some consensus as to the functions, and then form should follow function. This discussion should then drive the discussion about the architecture of global health, and which is the key for a global health system. However, it's not enough just to have these ideas. We also need ideals, and that's why we also need a new global ethic, which, as has been said many times, it's the ethic of universal rights. But this leads to the third and final paradox, and I'll end with this, which I call the accountability paradox. Because in a world polity constituted by sovereign nation states, the institutions charged with international collective action are accountable to the governments of those nation states and not directly to the people whose universal rights they are supposed to uphold. And yet a substantial proportion of those governments are either incapable of meeting the basic needs of their own populations because they are under acute stress, like in a disaster, or they are chronically failed or frail states, or worse, those states are themselves the main perpetrators of violations to those basic human rights. Since there are no signs that a global political authority will emerge accountable to the global population, to me, the only way of addressing the accountability paradox is by building the notion of global citizenship. And if you think about the notion of citizenship at the national level, it emerged through political and civil rights, but at the global level, citizenship has to emerge through social rights, of which the right to health is a fundamental one. A right-based approach, to me, opens an enormous field of action for this key function of global solidarity, because to fulfill this function, global actors, both in the public and in the civil society and private arenas, must often act as agents for the dispossessed. And the legitimacy of this role of serving as agents for the dispossessed lies in the fact that, you know, health is a universal aspiration, and it is the cornerstone, to me, of building global citizenship. I think this is, to me, the way forward in thinking about global governance. How do we solve the sovereignty paradox by sharing sovereignty through collective action? How do we address the dissonance paradox by thinking about a global health system? And how do we address the accountability paradox by building a global citizenship that starts with guaranteeing the effective exercise of the universal right to health? Thank you very much.
And for the second discussant for this paper, Professor Geeta Sen from the Indian Institute of Management.
Do you want the, should we bring out the platform? No, I can manage.
Okay.
Good morning. Thanks, Richard. First, good comment. Continuation of the freedom from PowerPoint. And the second one is that Julio is a hard act to follow. But some of what he said, particularly at the end, were in fact very close to the comments that I plan to make. I have four sets of very quick comments based on some reactions to Margaret's excellent summary of the issues, and also picking up on some of the points made by many of the really excellent, really good, fine presentations and discussions that we've had this morning. The first one is about, and I'm not going to say anything about globalization. I think both Margaret and Julio have said enough, and I agree with everything that they've said. But I'm going to focus my remarks really on the governance questions. Clearly, if we think about it, there are two aspects to governance, and sometimes these two aspects tend to get very confused in the ways in which we talk about them. There's a managerial aspect to governance, which is extremely important. Issues such as coordination, as coherence, if one uses the language of aid effectiveness, of government, of country ownership, and so on. Many of those are really about getting the management better, if not right. And surely we know that not just in the broad general area of aid effectiveness, but more specifically in the issue of health, those managerial or management questions are still largely unresolved and have a great deal, and there's a great great distance that we need to go in order to resolve them. Among these, of course, a dominant one, given all of the discussion that we've had already about the emergence of the silos, and the rapid proliferation of silos, is whether silos can ever become diagonal. That is, between the discussion about vertical programs and the need for horizontal health systems approaches, some people like Dean Jameson and others have argued about the importance of having maybe a more diagonal approach. And it's a very relevant and important question, I think, to ask whether if one starts with a silo, one can actually leverage that silo into becoming a mechanism for strengthening health systems. I think the jury is completely out on this. We have no idea. We've no idea if we focus, as we do in India under the National Rural Health Mission, on largely on maternal mortality, whether that will in fact end up strengthening the health system overall, or whether it will remain a separately funded silo that will never lead to any further improvements and which will in fact then perennially be rocked by the weaknesses of the health system. And if we are thinking of an area for research, I think certainly this is one where to which we need to pay a great deal of attention. But I would call this largely a managerial or a management type question. Although it borders on what is the second aspect of governance, which is the accountability issue. And Julio talked about the importance of accountability, and for me, accountability has a very simple description or definition. It's basically about the recognition, the naming, and the taming of power. And in the health world and in health systems, power operates in many and multiple ways, which in fact the proliferation of initiatives has in fact led to an proliferation also of the ways and the pathways through which power operates currently, both in the global as well as in national health systems. Now, non-state actors in this regard, of the type that Margaret speaks about in her paper and that all of us know quite well, are in some ways an easy target on this. Money coming in, large sums of money coming in separately, with, as I think she said in her paper, three trustees on a board to determine whether and how they should it should be spent in the way that it is. That's a perfectly valid question to ask, but in some ways it may be far too easy a target, letting go a lot of the other ways in which such things as the public goods aspects that Julio spoke about are in fact left as nobody's baby in the governance agenda. The cross-national brain drain, for instance, that Margaret speaks about in her paper, who's addressing that? Whose responsibility is it to ensure that all of the expenditures that are made on training health workers in one part of the world, it then ends up subsidizing health systems in other and much better off and much better financed parts of the world? Medical costs, the explosion of medical costs, and the fact that the costs of drugs and pharmaceuticals have gone through the roof. What do we, where and how are we able to deal with this at the global level that we need to, when we know perfectly well that it is one of the major reasons for the medical poverty trap that so many countries are currently facing. The problem we have, and you have in this country, an alcohol, tobacco, and firearms department, but what about the global processed food industry, which is probably singularly more responsible for the diabetes and cardiac problems that are exploding in countries like India and others? Do we have any mechanisms to control or even to regulate or even modify or even, you know, make it an ethical question? I think we don't. And I think that these are extremely important issues around accountability, because the synergy, again, as Julio said, between what we can do at the global level and what's possible at the national level is very, very great. And if there's an absence of synergy there, what you can't do at the global level is far more difficult to do at the national level. And McDonald's is only the tip of the iceberg in this regard. So it's little wonder then that at national level governance, there is so little focus. There is talk, but so little actual focus on equity questions, on issues of what you do about rising costs, or on who is being the most affected each one of those problems. At the global level, the WHO's Commission on the Social Determinants of Health raised a number of issues. Some people say it raised too many issues, and perhaps it did. But at another level, where is WHO actually taking this forward or doing anything with it? Having been part of the work of that commission over more than 2 years, I can say it's nowhere. We see it picked up by civil society groups, researchers, academics, here and there. But it's not made a significant dent on major debates around global governance and what ought to be happening in that field. The second set of points that I make is, and this is something that I didn't find in Margaret's paper, and I think is perhaps something that we ought to pay attention to, is if we are talking about global forces that are inimical to health, we really ought to pay attention to the global, regional, and national manifestations of anti-secular forces, including those that end up being significantly anti-women, anti-young people, homophobic, and with serious health implications across those. Can global governance in health really go forward without a human rights basis, which is what these questions raise in significant ways? When you have a G8 meeting in Toronto taking place, as happened before the MDGs meeting, on maternal mortality, and safe abortion, let alone family planning, are not even have to be fought to get onto that agenda, then I think that we see the proliferation and expansion of these forces, which as people interested in public health, we have to be deeply concerned about. Silence on these issues, the most recent thing that came rapidly across my email 2 days ago was the Ugandan newspaper that published openly the identities and names of 100 gay people with a yellow banner headline across the front which said, hang them. And these are issues that are politically difficult, but if we don't address them as public health people, then in fact we are missing what ought to be a very serious aspect of our mandate in terms of rights and health. And I think that as a collectivity, we ought to pay far more attention to this problem. The third question, which is linked to this, is where is the space for civil society in our discussions about global governance? Research on the successes, failures, the potential of civil society engagement is in fact sorely lacking. And I say this as someone who myself work very closely, sometimes at odds with different subgroups of civil society, and I'm a bit tired of civil society either patting itself on the back or being held up as the, you know, this is where you should go, without an adequate investigation of what works, what doesn't, in the way that we would for anything, any set of actions or anything else. The Global Fund and Gavi are being held up these days as being the models for better movement of getting stakeholders from the community more engaged and involved in processes of governance. Are these exceptions, or are they actually going to be pathbreakers? And I think the jury is very much out on that as well. But one thing that we do know is that much of the directions of moving health towards human rights that has taken place in the last two decades has been because of civil society movements. Not only the old arguments for Health for All and Alma Ata, but all of the new movements, whether around HIV or against women's rights, or increasingly youth coalitions speaking about what their rights and their engagement ought to be in the process. Perhaps the knowledge networks that this conference is moving towards might be a very good way in which to ensure that, in fact, it's these voices and these experiences that come in a far more important way into the debates and the discussions. Finally, my last point about governance is that somewhere here we have what one might call a right-hand, left-hand problem. The one not knowing what the other is doing, or the one unable knowing but unable to do anything about what the other is doing. Different aspects of globalization and what is happening in that regard stand parallel and outside to the discussion. And I was fascinated by I think it was Alistair's presentation of our, those dots about who said what. All of the climate change resource discussions were these brief dots somewhere on one corner, hardly mentioned at all. And yet, if one pays any attention to the debates and discussions around climate change and the kind of population movements that that is almost certainly going to lead to, we have a major public health, I won't say catastrophe, set of issues in the making that we really need to be paying much more attention to. The one that we do pay more attention to, but I'm not sure how well we pay attention to those, is of course trade agreements. And the impact that the trade agreements have been having on public health. And I want to end on a last note, which may not be a very optimistic one, but in this regard, but in our attention to the World Trade Organization, Doha, and the forward movement that public health was able to make, or thought it was able to make, at Doha, we haven't paid as much attention to the bilateral and the regional trade agreements. And one of the biggest challenges at this point, in the context, especially of Katharina's discussion about the possibility of new directions and reverse engineering happening through China, India, and so on, one of the biggest threats in that regard is a currently being negotiated EU bilateral agreement with India, which would effectively put a complete closure to the possibility of India functioning as any place from which you will get cheap pharmaceuticals in the future. If that goes through, that option is closed. But if you look at who's making an argument around those or who's mobilized around those, there's hardly a public health presence in those debates and those discussions. Thank you very much.
So for our last presentation, the paper on transforming health systems and achieving equity in health, written by Professor Marianne Jacobs from the University of Cape Town, and we'll have Kevin de Kock from the Centers for Disease Prevention and Control, and Carmen Barroso from the International Planned Parenthood Federation, Western Hemisphere region, as the two discussants. Marianne, thank you. We've got a
good afternoon. Clearly, the introduction of this platform is an attempt to promote equity in this meeting. Let me just start by thanking Linda and Richard and Alistair and Marnie and Colby and others that have made it possible for me to be here. And to say that if Gita said it was hard to follow Julio, think what it's like for me. Because, among other things, if you go to Google and you enter health systems, you get about 4.5 million entries. And of those 4.5 million entries, a substantial number would either have been written by Julio or you would have had something to do with it. So it's extremely intimidating to be up here. But I'm comforted by the fact that this morning I had breakfast with a very eminent public health academic who told me that he's chairing a committee on a topic about which he knows nothing. So that's very comforting for me. So let me start by just capturing in a very short presentation what has happened over the last decade in relation to health systems. And people have already spoken about the work of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health and the recommendations that they made for three major things, that if one wanted to achieve health equity, one needed to consider the social determinants of health and also look at improving daily living conditions, tackling the inequitable distribution of power, money, and resources, and most importantly, measuring and understanding the problem and assess the impact of action, which Geeta just spoke about now. The second big thing that's happened in the last decade to put emphasis on health systems is, of course, the primary healthcare revitalization initiative, and Sanya spoke about this earlier too. This was resulted in two documents that are of relevance, certainly for me coming from Africa, was the World Health Report of 2008, which spoke about now more than ever, we need to go back to the principles of primary health care. And the second was a meeting held in Ouagadougou in 2009, which resulted in a declaration. And this was for Africa, but it has relevance, I think, for the global community. And a range of issues with which we are all familiar, the Ouagadougou Declaration called for country ownership, resources, equity of access, harmonizing aid, health financing, health workforce, partnerships, and more. And I want you to just remember this. And of course, the last was the series of World Health Reports in the last decade, each of which have made some recommendation about health system strengthening. And we know that on the 22nd of November, the report on health systems financing, the road to universal coverage, will be launched, and really, again, emphasize the importance of looking at what this thing is and what we need to do about it, particularly since the issue of health systems was, of course, unleashed by the management or the capacity or lack thereof of systems to cope with the AIDS epidemic. So what do we have in 2010? We have a couple of new policies in the Global North which haven't been mentioned yet. First is in this country, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And what I read about it is that 47 million Americans are not covered by health insurance. And the other is in a paper called Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, written quite recently. There was a report that the US is not doing as well as many of its other northern counterparts. So the question is that Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act looking at health systems in this country and looking at health equity and equity of access to health care? The second one is a new white paper from the UK called Equity and Excellence Liberating the NHS. Sounds fairly progressive, but when one realizes that this is the 15th revision of the UK health policy, and I assume health system, in 30 years, it is a little bit scary, particularly if we are expected to take our direction from there. So that's one set of things that we have. We also have a global discourse on issues related to health systems and health equity, on universal coverage, health financing, scaling up, human resources for health, civil society, country ownership, and so on. Those are the themes that pervade the discussions on health systems and health equity in the literature and in many meetings and declarations. And all in all, everyone agrees, health systems are the target and country ownership is central. We have also various declarations on aid and how international aid should be made available, Paris Declaration, the Accra Agenda, and so on. And we know that there's lots of global health funding, or we hear that there's lots of global health funding. So with that, what is the reality in the Global South in relation to health systems? Well, first of all, in a paper written by the People's Health Movement, it was written for civil society and called a health systems agenda for developing countries, The paper raises all the issues that we know affect health systems in the global south. The inadequacy of resources, the fragmentation which is caused by uncoordinated global efforts, the effects of structural adjustment, unregulated private sector, and so on and so forth. So that's the one thing. Also, in relation to the Global South, there's a large group of people convened under the auspices of the WHO called the Maximizing Positive Synergies Collaborative Group. And they recently published a paper looking at the impact of global health initiatives on national health systems. And they realized that there are problems with the way in which global health initiatives undermine the capacity of countries to develop and strengthen their health systems. And they made four recommendations, talking about infusing the health systems agenda with the same energy that has been applied to other global health initiatives, to extending the targets, to seeking alignment, looking for more evidence and increasing funding. And again, the interesting thing, yet another declaration now from Venice. So we move from Paris to Accra to Venice, and an action plan in which a very, very detailed action plan in which there's a special section on what the research institutions should be doing. The third thing in terms of the Global South is the international development aid, and this paper by Devi Srinath from the Global Health Governance Project at the University of Oxford raised seven very important challenges in which he talks about what international aid, the challenges for strengthening, again, health and health systems in the South. Talks about the proliferation of initiatives and concern about the dream of coordination, which is sometimes a nightmare. The second is noting that global health aid is 6 to 66% of national health budgets. Apparently in Mozambique, 66% of national health budgets are accounted for by global aid. The need to maybe not look so much at new players, but look at how the old players can be reformed, and I think Margaret picked up on that in her paper. The downside of donor influence on agendas, and the fact that much of the global aid goes around government or through northern institutions. So in order to get aid in the south, you have to be linked to an institution in the north which may or may not take more or less than what the South is getting. So again, a set of recommendations for donors to be more accountable, for strengthening of national plans and leadership, and to look at lessons from South-South collaboration. So what about my own country, where the issue of national health insurance is high on the popular agenda and also on the agenda of the state? This information sheet comes from a group called SHIELD, which is an initiative. Some people from SHIELD are here. It is a collaboration looking at health insurance and economics, involving several African countries, also countries from outside of Africa, both in the south and the north. And the paper, which was put together by Di McIntyre from our own university, shows that, in fact, the poorest 40% of the population have about one-fifth of the benefits. If you look at the graph, the percentage share of need was based on an estimate of self-assessed health need, and you will see what proportion of the budget actually goes to those who are in greatest need. So we have a problem of inequity. Jerry spoke about it last night. And despite having a very progressive constitution and also having come through a legislated discrimination, we nevertheless have one of the highest Gini coefficients in the world. And we continue to struggle with issues of equity, which is why we are looking at a universal health system in South Africa and looking at the design implications. And if you look at this graph, again, produced by the Health Economics Unit at my university, you will see that looking at three scenarios, the cost of introducing a universal health system, depending on the cost of the package of care that goes into it, could be almost as high as 25% of our GDP, or it could be as low as 6.4%. So those calculations are still being done, and I think the more recent publications suggest that we may be able to introduce universal health coverage through a national health insurance system if we look very carefully at what it is that we are trying to do. So it's not enough if you're looking at universal coverage in order to look to attain healthcare equity if you just look at financing. There's more to universal coverage than financing. And I think that this ecosystems graphic is probably familiar to most here, which looks at the different impacts in the ecosystem on an individual's health. And it's clear that if one wants to go for universal health coverage in order to have equity of health, of access to health care, one would have to look at what the nature of the healthcare service is, what the health system actually looks like, particularly looking at human resources and other resources. It would be desirable to have policy and legislation which has equity at its core, that there be a national plan so that one includes all the social determinants in that system. The political will, which we saw in South Africa, can be so damaging if it's not there to access, in our case, to antiretrovirals. The issues of social justice and human rights, which both Julio and Gita have alluded to, are absolutely fundamental. We are fortunate in that we have a constitution in which human rights are central, but that doesn't mean that we've managed to translate that into a system which can actually be universal. So, what has our experience also shown us? That if we're thinking of human resources for universal healthcare and for health equity, we have to look at institutional capacity and retention. And it's that institutional capacity that's needed in order to generate the kinds of graphs that Di McIntyre and others have done. The capacity for health economics needs to be in countries. The capacity for health systems research needs to be strengthened within countries so that we don't have to depend on consultants or institutions from outside our countries, and that's fairly fundamental. We need capacity in our systems and to make sure that our systems enable people to stay in the system. In the movie last night, there was an obstetrician, I think in Uganda, who spoke about being the only obstetrician in the healthcare service for 100,000 people or more. I hope that he hasn't moved into one of the global health initiatives in Uganda, or worse, taken up a position outside of his country, which is what often happens. And the third is to look at capacity of human resources in the services and looking at the skills and capacities that are needed and issues of task shifting and so on. So global plans for health systems, what have we got beyond 2010? We have at least 10 World Health Reports, one coming up now, each one of them making recommendations. And I wasn't able to find any assessment of where those plans and recommendations have actually gone and what has happened to them. Similarly, with the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, and Gita spoke about it earlier, wonderful recommendations, many, many meetings over 2 years, people traveling all over the world to meet, and where are we now? Fantastic action plan, but we go on then to the next action plan. We have declarations on aid. We have a joint learning initiative on human resources for health that led to a Global Health Workforce Alliance. We have declarations on primary health care for Africa and globally. We have all these global health initiatives. Julio spoke about 120 of these global health players in the architecture. And then we have some newer global health initiatives, like the Medical Education Partnerships Initiative, like the Consortium of Universities with Global Health, the Grand Challenges, and the G8 recommendations that came out of Canada. So lots of plans, lots of intentions. And then, just on the 22nd of September, this is a new logo here, Ending Poverty from the MDGs. And I read through this thing from the General Assembly, and I may have been missing something, but it didn't look very different from, the calls weren't very different from those that were made at the beginning of this millennium. So what was interesting, though, is that there's a piece in the new plan for accelerating progress in promoting global public health for all. And it has the same call, the PHC principles, strengthening national health systems, affordable primary care, and so on and so forth. And in very fine print, right at the bottom of one section, there's this piece about further promoting research and development, which comes at the end of quite a long list. So my question is there hope for country ownership and sustainability of health systems in those countries that are most vulnerable and which need to be targeted if we want global equity, both in terms of access to healthcare and also in terms of outcomes? These people were interviewed, and they were asked about what they thought the possibilities were for countries to strengthen their national health systems. And I'm not going to read it for you. Lola Dare is Nigerian Executive Secretary of ECHOSHED. Hernan Rosenberg from the PAHO. Anne Mills from the London School. And Ron Waldman, who I'm not sure if he's here, but he's from this institution. And all in all, they have comments to make about whether there is hope for that kind of strengthening of health systems in those countries that need it most. So what do we have? What do countries in the global south have that we can use in our efforts to strengthen our health systems? Well, we've got information. And there is this is an open access journal. And in the very recent, there was a very recent volume on scaling up health services in low and middle income countries. One of the editors of that volume is right in the room here. And they raise a number of issues for scaling up, which is another one of the current fashions in the global health discourse. And so there is, we have information, we have networks like BIREMI, that can actually pull information together. We have institutions and programs with potential in the global south. We don't necessarily need to have our capacity strengthened. We need to have the resources in order to do that. We have schools of public health. In fact, in Africa, all the schools of public health are meeting in the next couple of days in Nairobi. We have many, many medical schools. We have research institutions across the global south. I see somebody from Fio Cruz is here. We have MPH programs. We have modules in health systems and health policy. So we have all the ingredients. And that doesn't mean to say we've got it all, but at least there are the beginnings of those ingredients. We have many, many knowledge networks and collaborations. And to name just a few, the Alliance for Health Policy and Health Systems Research, Sonia is a member of their board. They're having a big meeting on health systems research in Montreal in the middle of November. There's the Strategies for Health Insurance in Less Developed Countries, which includes a number of African countries in partnership with institutions like the London School and the Karolinska Institute. There's a Global Health Workforce Alliance, there's Equinet, the Consortium on Research for Equitable Health Systems, HEPNET. There's a joint learning network supported by Rockefeller, to which Judith Rodin mentioned that this morning. This is just the beginning of a list of many, many knowledge networks and collaborations. And then we have civil society, and I've noted Geeta's concerns about civil society, but we have some evidence that some organs of civil society have had impact. The Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa that led to the change in direction for antiretrovirals. And then, of course, there's the People's Health Movement, and just an advertisement for them, they are putting together the third Global Health Watch. They are calling for case studies, and perhaps the outputs of this meeting could go into the Global Health Watch as one piece for their consideration. And then lastly, there's lots of funding and collaboration. And let me just, I noticed that Alistair had this picture in his collage this morning. There's a consortium of universities for global health, which tends to be not a global consortium, but largely a US consortium. And then there's all this new money coming from the Obama administration, $63 billion for global health. And we heard this morning about the $20 billion. The question is, how much of this support and aid actually gets to those places where it's meant to have the greatest impact? So I'd like to suggest that there are three things we may want to talk, we may want to think about. The first is expanding concepts, not just of global health, but particularly the issue about which I was asked to talk. The issue of the concept of health care services equity and access, and the issues of equity of access, both at a national and global level, and the need to think about health systems equity more broadly in terms of equity of inputs, of processes, of outcome, and of impact, which would demand a different thinking about the framework for health systems. The second is to think about expanding the players. I've noticed that in this meeting, there are many, many representatives of schools of public health, but not of medical schools. And yet the issues of medical schools are also global issues. It's not just about global public health, but more broadly of health. And I do believe that more institutions should be involved beyond, of course, all the players we've spoken about, policymakers, civil society, and so on. And the last, I'd like to challenge Linda, who opened this morning by saying we should have a bifocal view. I think it should be multifocal. So thank you.
Thank you, Marion. Our first discussant is Kevin DeCock. And I think we need to, perhaps in the interest of equity, move this back.
Thank you. Good morning, and firstly, thank you to the organizers, and congratulations to the organizers for this, for inviting me and for hosting this very special meeting. So I represent a public health agency, the United States Public Health Agency, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and which obviously has its national counterparts in different countries, not all countries. A quick word on what we actually see as our role in global health, and as we struggle, in fact, with how should we as an agency adapt to this evolving situation and world. And really we see our role as based on three things. One, working with our country counterparts, and we actually have staff in close to 50 countries, to increase health capacity, the capacity to conduct surveillance, the necessary infrastructure for laboratory, public health laboratory work, and so on. Secondly, to assure that countries can assure their own populations' health security, that they have the ability to detect, investigate, diagnose, contain, respond to any particular health situation, any health challenge. And finally, to assure, achieve greater health impact, longer, safer, healthier lives in more places. And that's really what we strive for. I'm going to frame my comments in 10 questions. I'll speak rather fast to save time. And some of them are perhaps phrased rather bluntly, but I hope they'll contribute to the discussion. I'm struck by two things. One is that many of the questions don't have any obvious answers, at least not yet. And secondly, how many of these questions have actually come up as individual points in the different excellent presentations that we've heard earlier this morning. So the first is, you know, in this discussion of systems or global health in general, who's in charge? I think 20 years ago, I think the World Health Organization and the decision-making authority of the World Health Assembly really were quite formidable, and it's sort of fragmented since then. It's fragmented particularly since the advent of large sums of money, so that those who have the money, that's the golden rule, he who has the gold rules, that has profoundly changed the situation, including, interestingly, by philanthropic organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who, for whom I have a great admiration and respect for that particular foundation. But it is interesting that in terms of accountability, it's not clear where that actually lies, other than to the benefactor. But they obviously have had a major and very positive influence in global health. Who sets the agenda? And what do we actually mean by country ownership? We, you know, it's a phrase that's frequently used. It's used in the Obama administration's Global Health Initiative as one of the key principles, but it's one that merits better definition. Where did all this come from? And what are the big ideas and themes? In the excellent paper that Marion wrote, although she didn't mention it in the presentation just given, she particularly alluded to the 2000 World Health Report. I actually think that a lot of this goes back a bit earlier. And I think a very key development actually was the 1993 World Development Report from the World Bank, Investing in Health. I think that was a seminal document, and it was through the 90s that various influential figures emphasized that HIV, TB, and malaria were really having a disproportionate impact in sub-Saharan Africa, and I think that influenced what's happened since then. We've heard about we haven't mentioned the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, although Dr. Brundtland was mentioned. And I think another very important event actually was the evaluation of WHO's 3x5 program, because it was that which was that gave the reaction to HIV/AIDS treatment scale-up, that actually the fundamental problem was health systems, and it particularly emphasized the human resource issue. But what struck me over the last, of what's happened over the last few years is that there have been these big themes, the large global health programs, particularly PEPFAR, the Global Fund, the MDGs, the debate about health systems, the social determinants of health, the re-emphasis of primary health care, and all of this could have been pulled together in one vision. And actually what happened is that it all went centrifugal. And some of these things became very competitive and antagonistic. If you thought that it was a good idea to have an AIDS program, then obviously you were against health system strengthening. And I think it's coming back together again, but I actually think this debate was in some ways quite destructive. Question number three. Well, what is the question? Is it how to strengthen health systems, or is it because, you know, you can only start from where you are and there's 20 plus billion dollars out there, and it's going on things like PEPFAR and the Global Fund, is the question, how do you maximize the benefit of these big rather vertical initiatives? How do we use those to get to where we want to go? What I think the question is not about, which again was kind of negative, is, you know, is the Global Fund a good idea, and is PEPFAR bad or good? And a lot of energy has unfortunately gone into that. I'm troubled about the science, and I'm perhaps a reductionist. I'm a clinician by training and have ended up in public health and epidemiology, and I respect and agree to some extent with Carlos's earlier comments about the limits of epidemiology, though I do think it's a very elegant science. I'm struck that whereas in a lot of biomedical situations, practical problems can usually be reduced to discrete entities that can be investigated. That doesn't seem to be the case with health systems. And I think we're in a sort of analogous situation as we are with economic development in low-income countries that, to my ill-informed perspective, we sort of don't really understand it. We don't, you know, why is Kenya so far behind South Korea when 30 years ago, or whenever it was, they were at the same, that very frequently thrown out Ghanar. I don't really understand it, and I'm troubled. I think we need to do better with communicating the science that is going into our health systems debate. What I do think also is that we need a lot of emphasis on impact, outcomes, metrics, and measurement, and communicating them clearly. Where's public health in all of this? Because a lot of the discussion about health systems actually is about clinical care. It needs to be about both. We at CDC, and this is purely for our own work, it's not supposed to be comprehensive. We had a lot of discussion about this, is how do we as a public health agency with a global presence engage in this discussion? And for us, the priorities are health information systems and surveillance, research for policy change and program implementation, the development of the workforce in the broadest sense, and laboratory capacity strengthening, and all of that in support of program implementation and other infrastructure development. You notice that we say nothing about financing, not that that isn't critical, but simply it's just not what we have the greatest expertise in. It is critical, obviously. I show this only to make a comment about public health, but also to say actually we do still need clearer definition of what we actually mean and what the boundaries are of health system strengthening when we talk about it. I am personally troubled, because of my work, by the relationship, and again the sometimes communicated apparent antagonism between health, acute public health interventions, and the whole issue of economic development. We know that health is wealth and wealth is health. We know that, I mean, the lessons from the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health that health investments can lead to development, and certainly development leads to health or is associated with health. There are very interesting outliers, the United States being one of them in the negative sense. But what I'm troubled by in this discussion is that and this is actually a rights issue, that sometimes this emphasis on systems and the long-term view of development seems to forget that actually we have huge responsibilities to birth cohorts who are currently alive or currently being born, as well as those for the future. And the term sustainability, which is that the development community uses so often, is I think a truly troubling one, because in many of the places that we work, disease is far more sustainable than any particular part of the health system. In these discussions on health systems, I do argue that we have to put more emphasis on health outcomes. Health system strengthening has to lead to improved health indicators, and there has to be much better communication around the impact that we are seeking and hopefully achieving. And to use a sentence that in an article that Wafel Sadra and I wrote a year or 18 months ago, health systems have to be seen as actually serving real people, people with identities who actually suffer from health problems that have names. It's not systems just for the sake of having a system. What's wrong with vertical? Well, we know there's plenty wrong with vertical, and that's to some extent what stimulated this whole debate. But we do face somewhat of a conundrum that, and I think sometimes we sort of play things down too much. We have achieved extraordinary successes over the last 10 to 20 years. If you look at the mortality reduction in Africa that has occurred because of the scale-up of AIDS treatment programs or AIDS services in general, the trends in tuberculosis, the extraordinary reductions in malaria that have happened in just the last few years, vaccine coverage, the almost eradication, not yet, but the almost eradication of polio. All of these are, quote, rather vertical interventions. The experience of Zambia in the 1990s, when it dismantled its tuberculosis program to make it integrated with the rest of its system, was actually quite disastrous and led to an escalation in tuberculosis, very bad program performance, and real problems. So we have to sort of accommodate these observations and some of these requirements. Male circumcision for HIV prevention, not a magic bullet, as Peter reminded us, but interestingly, the only intervention for which we have three randomized controlled trials that show the greatest benefit of almost all our proven interventions, a 60% reduction in incidence in men. If ever we're going to use that benefit, and there's a dire need to do so, it isn't going to come quickly from investing in general health systems and hoping that in 20, 30, 40 years, maybe maybe circumcision coverage will be rather high. It's going to have to be, if we want to do this, it's going to have to be a much more targeted sort of intervention. And the same is true for some of the neglected tropical disease interventions. So this is not easy, and we have to bring these views together. Who's going to pay the issue of that's come up of financing? Global health needs global financing. I think we should communicate that and advocate around it. And I also think there's enough money in the world to pay for health. I do think there's a need for political pressure on others who could step up to the table to do so, including some of the emerging economies, the oil-rich economies, and so on. And there are very interesting cultural links that could be exploited to do that. I think scientific work on innovative financing mechanisms deserves much more attention. Very small levies on very frequent transactions that are practiced widely across the world could actually raise substantial sums of money. One thing that clearly does not work and just exploits the most vulnerable is point-of-care charges, which often cause more problems than they solve. And finally, what is the answer? There is no one answer, that is clear. And we don't really know what the answer is. But there are some interesting points thrown out. Many of them have come up in discussion this morning. The issue of equity, I think, merits a lot more discussion. Do we talk about it simply because it's the right thing to do? Or do we talk about it because it's smart from a public health perspective, that actually you get a disproportionate impact if you focus your interventions on the most vulnerable? And I think that's a very important question. Do you go for, in public health benefit, do you go for big countries, Nigeria, Ethiopia, etc., China, in terms of years of life gained, or do you go for groups that are particularly disadvantaged? Interestingly, UNICEF in its recent policy has just made equity the very center of its approach. Business approaches, incentives, meaning, incentives, we do that, that's done to some extent in clinical medicine, I think, as was mentioned, but actually using incentives like, for populations to remain HIV negative, not to smoke, to do various healthy lifestyles and so on, and certainly better science. In conclusion, I don't think we know, but we have to do better. Thank you very much.
So for our last discussant, Carmen Barroso from IPPF-WHR.
think organizers of conferences should take into account the height of speakers so that they don't have to move back and forth the platform. Standing between you and lunch, I'm keenly aware of the need to stick to the 5 minutes I was asked to make some comments, and I really appreciate that I was invited to speak about equity, because that is, I think, at the crux of the matter. So I'd like to make 3 comments on aspects that I believe our discussions should go beyond the current debates. First, Marian mentions the need to redress the inequities regarding the poor and vulnerable. But I think we need to unpack who are the vulnerable. We should look at equity beyond the major inequities regarding income and wealth. These are, of course, the most glaring inequities, but there are others which are rampant but do not receive much attention. I would like to focus on 2 in particular, because they affect huge numbers, being a large proportion of the population. And I'm referring to age inequities and gender inequities. Gender inequities plague health systems in many ways, in the workforce, in lack of attention to victims of gender-based violence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to mention this to you. Adolescents, in particular, have much more restricted access to health services. And health services seldom cater to their needs. One of the reasons they are neglected is that on many aspects, they are a relatively healthy bunch. The services that the health systems could offer them in a friendly manner, though, have wide-ranging implications for the rest of their lives. Take, for instance, tobacco use prevention. Take, for instance, access to contraceptive services, an area in which unmet need of adolescents tends to be twice as large as that of adults. An unwanted pregnancy at this age can be life-threatening, especially when an unsafe abortion is seen as the only solution possible. It can also be life-transforming, whatever the course of action taken. Of course, there are many other mental and physical health needs of adolescents that usually go unattended. They are so important that I suggest that we start talking about the poor, the adolescents, and other vulnerable groups. Let's stop their invisibility, and let's stop adding them at the end as an afterthought, as a footnote. My second point is that we need to pay more attention to the diverse components of health systems. Linda gave us definitions of health systems. Peter said we probably don't need to define the boundaries of health systems. But I have the feeling we are living in a platonic world of ideal types when Katharina presented the stark realities of differences between the public and the private health systems in Chile. And that's not only in Chile, of course. So, Marian mentioned briefly the role of the private sector, but most of the time when we talk about the public health system, we're talking about the government-sponsored systems, or we talk about the whole system without examining the differences of the various components. We should think about the equity implications of the for-profit sector, the religious nonprofit sector, and the secular nonprofit sector. The equity implications are quite significant when, for instance, the religious sector, which you know plays a major role in many countries, refuses key services that it deems unacceptable from their particular set of values, as is the case of contraception and abortion, again, my favorite area. Should the secular nonprofit be strengthened to counterbalance this inequity? Consideration of the for-profit sector is also important for a discussion that is much needed about targeting the poor and promoting universal access. Is targeting the poor the most efficient way of promoting equity, or is it reinforcing a double standard of poor care for the poor? My third point expands on what Marian said about the contribution of civil society towards holding governments accountable, and she also mentioned the importance of political will, social justice, and human rights. Actually, strengthening and redesigning health systems to achieve equity is as much or more a political than a technocratic question. Richard, for instance, has raised the underrepresentation of the South in global health systems decision-making. How can equity be promoted in health system until there is broad political democratization so that the poor and other disenfranchised groups are empowered to demand the equitable health systems they need? The enormous difficulty of promoting change in the U.S. is a clear demonstration that the promotion of greater equity is not in the hands of some enlightened specialists such as ourselves, but depends on control of public opinion and the creation of political will. The same way, remember that Gita and others also mentioned the important role of social movements in global public health, including Alma Ata, the HIV movement, and more recently, the youth movement. So the same way that the social determinants act powerfully in affecting the health outcomes well beyond the inputs of health systems, also, the broader political and social forces establish the parameter within which the health systems will work, either reinforcing inequities or mitigating them. Julia's support for a global citizenship seems in the right direction. So should we discuss how we develop it? The need to give serious thinking to gender inequities and to the invisibility of adolescence, the importance of critical thinking about the private for-profit, the religious, and the secular nonprofit sectors, and the fact that the empowerment of the disenfranchised is essential for tackling inequities in health systems. These are the three points I would like to leave with you for consideration, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
There is a delicate balance between hunger and indigestion. I'm aware that it's about 5.5 hours since you might have eaten a croissant or a Danish pastry, and lunch is awaiting us. And yet also this morning we've had a huge amount of material to assimilate, and we very much want to begin to model a discussion of that and the digestion of that. The good news is that all of our program this afternoon and all of our program tomorrow is very much directed at the opportunity to digest the diverse contentions and suggestions that were made this morning. It feels though that we shouldn't go to lunch without giving the opportunity for a handful of people just to give some initial reaction in a declarative way to some of the contentions and the suggestions that have been made. There are microphones on the tables. I'd like you to, if there's something you'd like to say, let's try and make it a sentence or two. This is not the time for speechifying. We have our stomachs to fill. But it is the time to have a sense from people who've not spoken as a reaction, either in terms of agreement and affirmation or in terms of controversy. So Christina at the back, if you take a microphone and stand, you'll be switched on.
Thank you. Thank you. It's on. Thanks very much for stimulating, although lengthy, morning.
I'm Christina Zarowski. I'm at the University of Western Cape. I left a Canadian, very nice funding agency, rather smug, IDRC, a year ago. And let me tell you, it looks totally different being on faculty at a historically black university, which means relatively little money and relatively little prestige. So that colors all of my reactions to, so far, what this morning has been sharing. I just wanted to raise a couple of comments. One was, for me anyway, a perennial ambivalence between excitement at the can-do Americanism and also some discomfort at the kind of triumphalist, ever new, ever innovative, ever better movement. And are we at risk rather of evergreening in the pharmaceutical tradition rather than true innovation? How can we think about creating spaces to remember history, to remember social theory, to think about that, to learn from each other, to create opportunities and processes and mechanisms where we can actually innovate in our own environments without constantly feeling like, okay, well, Commission for Social Determinants of Health, that's last week's conceptual framework, we need another one today. So that's the kind of the big concern about that. I kept thinking of reading over somebody's shoulder on a bus in Ottawa about there being two medieval institutions active in the world today. One is the church and the other is the university. For good and ill. So can we not? Can we be a little less Protestant, where we create a new sect and a new church for every new movement? Can we remember a bit of our history? Can we remember Wallerstein? Those of us who, you know, trained in social sciences a couple of decades ago. Can we learn across our disciplines? And also just thinking across disciplines and across our constituencies. My experience so far in a year with managers and practitioners in South Africa is that far from being incapable of absorbing change and innovation, they are barraged constantly by change and innovation and are doing their best to try to absorb it and to manage that in a wildly changing landscape. Last comment, I don't know if the bifocal metaphor was meant to be ironic. In Canada, bifocals are passé. Even multifocals are passé. We're into progressives, so can that shape our thinking?
Thanks. Robert.
Yes, I'm Robert Carr from the International Council of AIDS Service Organizations. I spent the last 10 years doing a lot of community organizing and addressing health systems issues for particularly vulnerable groups, which is the background for what I want to say briefly, that I'm struck by a tension that kept repeating itself throughout the presentations that I'm really hoping we'll be able to manage as we go through the next day and a half, which is between the level of sort of sophisticated systems level abstracted analysis of how health systems work, how health systems could be reformed, and the tension between that and remembering that the point of health systems is really to increase the health of people on the ground who are very diverse, especially people who are particularly marginalized, particularly excluded from systems as a whole, but who are particularly hard hit by exclusion from health systems. So we heard, for example, some of that coming through in the last speaker who spoke about the needs of adolescents. This has a lot of challenges if we go back up to health systems, for example, around whether or not governments and the issues of country ownership, whether or not they're prepared to provide sex and reproductive health services to adolescents. That's just one example. There are multiple constituencies that we could talk about like that, but I'm really hoping that over the next day and a half, we can continue to try and remember who the beneficiaries of health systems are meant to be. Thank you.
Gary.
Hi, I'm Gary Cohen with Becton Dickinson. We cast the net very wide this morning, that's my impression, which is great from the standpoint of taking a holistic view, but I would really hope that as we go into this afternoon's discussions, we'll be able to focus on some actionable constructs to try to cull down this broad-based set of information that we had to a series of areas that can represent meaningful follow-through from the conference. And one construct that I think may be helpful looking at these issues systemically is to try to determine where are we acting on symptoms, investing in treating symptoms, versus where are we trying to remove barriers that could enable us to deal with the symptoms more effectively, and where are we dealing with underlying causes. And to make that a more poignant or meaningful statement, you know, if you think about HIV/AIDS, the majority of the investment today goes to symptoms. People contract the disease and we invest in antiretroviral treatment. I think one of the speakers this morning said 80% or so of today's investment and HIV/AIDS goes for treatment. And we know that we'll never win the battle against HIV that way because people are still contracting the disease more rapidly than they can be put on treatment. Then we talk about barriers. Health system strengthening has emerged since, let's say, 2006 as a primary barrier to further expanding treatment access. And even there, as we make the additional investment, which is absolutely necessary and will carry benefits well beyond HIV/AIDS, it's still not going to affect the underlying causes. And one, the last speaker spoke about gender inequities is clearly emerging as one of the several underlying causes. If you look at the prevalence among young females, particularly in high prevalence regions, it's way, way out of proportion. For example, in Swaziland, the country with the highest HIV prevalence in the world, 38% prevalence among females in the 20 to 24 year age cohort versus 11% for males. And I think evidence would indicate that investments in reducing the underlying causes are the most cost effective. Certainly in this example that I used, investment in the outcomes or the symptoms are the least cost effective, but they also tend to be the most challenging because you deal often with behavioral issues as opposed to therapeutic interventions. And I do think we have to put more focus on these behavioral issues that impact underlying causes as a means of getting ahead of some of these issues. But all that was just as an example to say, let's think about some actionable constructs so we can take all this great information from this morning and drive it forward.
Thanks very much. A final word before lunch, Howard.
Thank you. Howard Frumkin from the University of Washington School of Public Health in Seattle. If we were a gathering of ecologists and zoologists here to talk about the global health of butterflies or rodents, you can be sure that we would have put species habitat at the center of our discussion. But I'm struck by how peripheral human habitat has been to the discussion this morning. These are the issues in the Northwest, probably no accident, in the Northwest part of Alistair's slide this morning. Climate change, with all the implications that will have for agricultural output, for infectious disease risk, and so on. Depletion of resources such as water, land, petroleum. And I'll note in passing that the good news story in last night's wonderful documentary was the woman in difficult labor who got a ride to the district hospital. She might not have gotten that ride if gasoline had been selling for $15 a gallon instead of $4 a gallon, as it will before long. I want to urge that if global health is in fact a new paradigm, part of that paradigm needs to be that we think geographically, we think in resource terms, we think in ecological terms, and understand that many of the physical changes in the world are the context in which human health exists. So I urge that in our discussions, it won't be easy this afternoon because this set of issues, fundamental as it is, doesn't fit into any of the four buckets that we've got for our discussion. Very important omission, but this very much needs to be at the heart of our discussion.
Thanks very much, Howard. I'm standing over here partly as a signal to where your lunch is. We are going to go through there. There are bags for the lunch. You can either stay in that corridor or area, or if you want to go through to the square open outside, you're very welcome to. The bags are very clearly marked in terms of what's in them. There includes vegetarian and non-vegetarian option. And a process thing, I was disappointed that I'm having to cut out two or three people who then wanted to speak, but the whole of this afternoon and all of tomorrow is very much to give the opportunity for those voices in these tables to begin to shape discussion, and very much as Gary was suggesting, to drill down from this visionary level towards concrete actions and agenda. So enjoy your lunch. Please come back at 1:55 so we can start promptly at 2:00. Thank you.